disease gave the story credibility in popular culture. Similar to the protocols of the Elders of Zion, the AIDS disinformation campaign continues to live in urban myth and conspiracy theory. A 2005 study conducted by the U.S. National Institute of Child Health and Human Development showed that almost half of 500 African Americans surveyed believed that the AIDS-causing HIV virus is man-made. More than one quarter believed that AIDS was produced in a government laboratory, and 12% believed it was created and spread by the CIA. In the Sudan in 1969, a group of goat herders found a cache of weapons in a drain pipe along a rural trail. Hidden for the purpose of discovery, the eclectic collection included a pen gun, box of ammunition, and magnetic limpet mine that could be attached to the side of a ship. There was also a note implicating a U.S. State Department official in an alleged political plot against the Sudanese government. The timing of the goat herders' discovery was nearly flawless. Sudan had broken diplomatic ties with the United States following the 1967 Arab-Israeli War. Thereafter, each country maintained official relations through interest sections housed in an embassy that flew the flag of a different nation. Adding to an already complicated situation were the policies of Sudan's new government that seemingly leaned toward Moscow. American diplomats in Khartoum needed to reveal the materials as fabrications and defuse the potential for political crisis certain to follow any public release about the find. A break came when a senior Sudanese official, Major Farouk Othman Hamdallah, Minister of Interior and State Security, privately let one of his American contacts know that he would make the goat herders' find available for examination if the examiner was not an official U.S. representative. Crown was briefed on the situation and instructed to go to Ethiopia. With the Ethiopian visa in his passport, he then sought a tourist visa from a Sudanese consular clerk in Washington. Since he would be in the neighboring country, Crown implored, he would like to take a few additional days as a tourist to visit the Sudan and experience its culture, history, people, and land. It was his lifelong dream to walk in the footsteps of the great Mahdi, who had slaughtered General Gordon in Khartoum in the 1880s. In return for the performance, Crown received a tourist visa and checked into Khartoum's Acropole Hotel a few days later. Unnoticed by Sudanese officials, Crown was introduced to U.S. Chargé d'Affaires George Curtis Moore, who had a reputation for being less than friendly to CIA activities. However, Moore's apprehension evaporated as the two discovered a common sense of humor, along with the realization that Crown's expertise might resolve a difficult problem. Moore arranged for Crown to examine the goat herder's find at Major Hamdallah's private residence. There Crown found the limpet bomb, a pen gun, ammunition, and a typewritten note set out on a small table. After greeting the examiner, Hamdallah gave instructions to his servant and left the house along with Moore. "Have the servant call me when you're finished," said Moore, "and I'll come back to pick you up." "Great idea," Crown remembered thinking. "Here I am, by myself, an American on an irregular tourist visa, in a country the United States doesn't have diplomatic relations with, unable to speak the local language, and sitting in the Minister of Interior's house handling deadly devices. If something happens, I don't even know how to use the phone. If a couple bad guys come through the door, I'm in deep trouble." There was little to do except get to work. The servant offered the examiner bottles of Coke and Fanta. Based on briefings he received prior to his trip, Crown, although not an explosives expert, identified the limpet mine as a U.S. device, probably recovered by the Cubans from the Bay of Pigs and subsequently given to the Soviets. The pen gun was of Pakistani manufacture and easily available in the Horn of Africa region. Major Hamdallah's servant brought another round of Coke and Fanta. Crown examined each letter on the typewritten note under a microscope and referred often to his typewriter key classification. He eventually concluded the note had been written on an Olympia typewriter of recent manufacture. While American government officials were not known to use that model of Olympia typewriter, it was widely available in both West Germany and East Germany. These findings, although limited, were based on solid data and professional examination. That evening, Moore, Crown, and Hamdallah sat on red vinyl cushions in the minister's green curtain-draped living room. In presenting his findings and his conclusions, Crown described the typewriter involved, talked about how the U.S. government produced its official documents, and offered the determination that the circumstances of the find, the origin of the materials, and the content of the document itself pointed to a covert plot by the Soviets or their allies. Hamdallah listened politely, said little, and offered no commitment to cooperate. He did consent to a request by Crown to pose for a photo, while Moore expressed appreciation for Crown's work, which he believed had been sufficient to instill doubt in Hamdallah. The case was closed. Crown's visit had an unexpected impact on both Moore and Hamdallah. Within 2 months, Major Hamdallah requested to see Crown again. This time, Sudan would welcome the examiner as an official visitor, and Moore would insist that Crown stay at his residence. Hamdallah wanted more details about typewriter markings and other forgeries in Africa at the time. From Moore's perspective, the meetings between U.S. officials and a senior Sudanese minister represented otherwise unobtainable openings for diplomatic contacts. Sudanese President Jafar Numeri gradually shifted away from his Soviet bloc orientation in 1969 and 1970, prompting an unsuccessful leftist coup in 1971. Hamdallah, one of the coup supporters, was in London at the time, but decided to return to Sudan in an attempt to re-establish an anti-Numeri organization. Arrested en route, he was returned to Sudan in custody, tried, and shot. After Hamdallah's death, details of his secret life were revealed. The Sudanese minister had cooperated at various times with East German as well as U.S. intelligence services. Marcus Wolf, former head of East Germany's foreign intelligence arm, described Hamdallah as an intimate contact with whom he had developed a close personal as well as professional friendship. With Numeri still in power and Hamdallah replaced, Moore arranged for Crown to brief Ziad Asati, a senior Sudanese police official, on the scope of Soviet and indigenous forgeries circulating in the region. Sati listened attentively and recommended Moore and Crown take their information to the new interior minister. The minister expressed particular interest in examination techniques and quizzed Crown on U.S. prison construction before introducing the team to Brigadier General Rashid al-Din, head of the Sudanese National Security Agency. Al-Din was likewise receptive to the presentation, even mentioning the East Germans by saying, "You won't see them around here anymore." Then, unexpectedly, Al-Din brought up a name from Crown's past. Major Hamdallah had been a patriot, although now a dead one. A month later, the climb up Sudan's diplomatic ladder continued with the CIA's senior document examiner meeting President Numeri himself. Crown recited his well-practiced litany of the many Soviet-originated forgeries bouncing around Africa. Numeri was attentive and raised the subject of the 1969 find and the .22-caliber pen gun. Crown retold the story and his conclusions that the cash likely originated with the Soviets or East Germans. Still suspicious about the CIA and its possible connection to the failed 1971 coup, the African leader probed Crown for information about his background and professional credentials. Crown responded that as a mid-level Pentagon forensic examiner, he cooperated with the Department of State and other U.S. government agencies when asked to do so. Numeri soon moved on to alleged Chinese support for Anyanya forces opposing his government, showing him photos and posters to analyze, then requested training for Sudanese examiners. The diplomat, Moore, quickly injected himself into the discussion, commenting that the U.S. government had many ways it could help, and he would be pleased to work out the details. As they left the president, Moore observed, "Dave, we make a great vaudeville team." Crown replied, "Yes, and we played the palace." Both noted the irony in the fact that 3 years earlier, a likely East German forgery intended to discredit the United States with the Sudanese had become the key to unlocking the door of normalized diplomatic relationships between the two countries. An invitation to return to Khartoum arrived on Crown's desk in March 1972. Sati, who had been promoted to Director General of Sudan's Ministry of Interior, and President Numeri were asking for another briefing. Crown reviewed his findings on the Chinese photographs, which were likely the work of Soviet propaganda. Numeri expressed annoyance at policies of the Soviet bloc, Libya, and Egypt intended to influence the Sudan. The U.S.-Sudanese relationship warmed with Numeri's changed policy, and career Foreign Service officer Cleo Noel became the U.S. ambassador to the Sudan. George Moore remained at his post in Khartoum, serving with Ambassador Noel until March of 1973, when both were taken hostage during a reception held at the Saudi Arabian embassy and executed the next day by Black September terrorists. That event was one of many during the 1970s that would commit Crown, the QDL, and every other component of the TSD to America's war on terrorism. Increasingly, the document examiners would turn their attention to understanding, tracking, and exposing the travel and identification papers used by terrorists. Already, it was evident that passports, visas, and other documentation essential for terrorism could be forged, purchased from a commercial vendor, created from stolen blanks, altered from valid passports, or procured with assistance from corrupt officials. According to a CIA report, clandestine travel facilitators, key enablers of terrorism, passports for terrorists were available for purchase from drug addicts in foreign countries or forgers based in Chad or Saudi Arabia. A genuine passport could be purchased in Pakistan with bogus visa stamps to age it. Putting their knowledge of forgeries to work, the QDL created a passport examination manual known as the Red Book. The manual, with a distinctive fire engine red cover, included samples of forged passports, stolen passports, and fabricated entry-exit stamps. In all, the Red Book contained exemplars of 35 forged passports and cachets from 45 different countries. Each example was illustrated in color with its faults clearly marked. Printed in 6 languages, the Red Book was made available to U.S. Customs and Immigration officials and countries cooperating with U.S. counterterrorism and counter-narcotics programs. The 1986 edition of the Red Book reported that over 50 individuals carrying forged passports provided by terrorist organizations had been identified before they could carry out their terrorism assignments. The Red Book's authors also concluded a brief introduction to document examination with a cautiously optimistic yet ominous paragraph that read, "Terrorism is a plague that threatens all of us. It must be stopped. Use the Red Book, whether at border control, police registration, or visa application. If we screen travelers and check their passports, as experience proves, terrorists will lose their ability to travel undetected, and international terrorism will come one step closer to being stopped. The threat is real." The threat was indeed real. In 1986, as international terrorism continued to grow, OTS document specialists trained hundreds of immigration and border control officials to spot spurious passports, visas, travel cachets, and other forms of documentation. OTS supplemented the Red Book and training with a film titled The Threat is Real that was translated and distributed among law enforcement personnel in any country willing to cooperate with the U.S. counterterrorism effort. By 1992, use of the Red Book and a companion passport examination manual had been credited for the apprehension of more than 200 individuals carrying forged passports provided by terrorist groups. The manuals were annually updated as the quality and sophistication of the terrorist documents improved each year. Time showed that terrorists became better at forging passports and rapidly adapted computer software to help them with forgeries. Instruction booklets began circulating among terrorists on how to clean visa cachets and alter passports. Genuine official documents came from Arab volunteers fighting in Afghanistan who were ordered to give their passports to commanders upon arrival at their unit. If killed, the volunteers' documents were altered, usually by photo substitution, and passed along to another operative. Prior to 9/11, Al-Qaeda mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed traveled on a Saudi passport with bogus cachet stamps to age it. Now, 25 years after Kurt Moore's death, the war on terrorism would dominate U.S. intelligence. Chapter 19. Tracking Terrorist Snakes. We have slain a large dragon, but we now live in a jungle filled with a bewildering variety of poisonous snakes. R. James Woolsey, in congressional testimony after the collapse of the USSR. The agency's war against terrorism began decades before September 11, 2001. The CIA's chief in Athens was assassinated in December 1975. In October 1983, terrorists used a truck bomb to blow up the Marine barracks in Beirut, murdering 241 U.S. soldiers. That same year, terrorists bombed the U.S. Embassy in Beirut, killing 63, including CIA officers. Then, in 1984, CIA's chief in Lebanon, William Buckley, was kidnapped, tortured, and later murdered in 1986. That same year, DCI William Casey created the DCI Counterterrorist Center, staffed by representatives from the principal intelligence community agencies, with a mission to preempt, disrupt, and defeat terrorists. While radical groups with diverse agendas, such as the Baader-Meinhof Gang, the IRA, and the Weathermen, committed terrorist acts during the 1960s, America saw the face of terrorism up close during the 1972 Olympics in Munich. Broadcast live on international television, the dramatic scenes of masked Palestinian terrorists killing 11 Israeli athletes seemed as senseless as it was shocking. To the CIA, the only new aspect of the appalling spectacle in Munich was its global broadcast. Acts of terror carried out by religious and political fanatics, either independently or with government sponsors, have influenced societies and destabilized governments for centuries. In the 11th century, a Muslim sect, the Order of the Assassins, conducted suicide missions with the promise of paradise to follow. English Catholics conspired to blow up Parliament in 1605 in hopes of creating an uprising against King James I. The list of terrorist acts through history includes virtually every country and continent. However, in the last half of the 20th century, the frequency of terrorist strikes accelerated dramatically. According to one account, 8,114 terrorist incidents occurred worldwide during the 1970s. In the 1980s, that number increased nearly 400% to more than 30,000. Advances in technology have aided terrorists in their efforts. New chemistries have reduced the amount of explosives needed to inflict significant damage, and television coverage typically allocates airtime relative to the number of people killed or injured. It can be argued that the net effect motivates increasingly more heinous acts in an attempt to attract the attention that drives public fear. Targeting civilians is a fundamental terrorist tactic. In the 19th century, the radical German revolutionary Karl Heinzen envisioned a time when weapons of mass destruction, powerful enough to destroy entire cities, would be in the hands of terrorists. Stopping that from happening became one of CIA's most important missions. The first OTS officer assigned to Vietnam, Pat Jameson, may have been the first OTS tech drafted into the war on terrorism. During the early 1970s, terrorists were using tools already well known to Jameson, including false identities and documentation, along with special weapons and improvised explosive devices. His experiences in Vietnam and Laos with target analysis and planning paramilitary operations allowed him to understand how terrorists identified target vulnerabilities and traveled undetected. When the United States left Vietnam in 1973, OTS reassigned Jameson from Laos to one of its covert European bases. Now a seasoned tech with experience in both paramilitary and audio surveillance operations, he would become a primary agency resource for creating counterintelligence programs in Europe and Middle Eastern countries. Early counterterrorism operations concentrated on putting audio devices into residences and offices of suspected terrorists. The strategy, Jameson recalled, paid off handsomely, particularly in Western European countries, where members of terrorist cells were often long-time residents and believed their radical activities were protected. For the agency, these operations not only assisted countries in preventing attacks, they also provided a means to solidify and expand cooperation with local security services. Jameson found that many Middle Eastern countries were overly confident in their attitudes, thinking themselves immune from terrorist acts. Several countries, including friends of the United States, ignored or failed to take action against terrorist groups at home as long as they conducted their attacks elsewhere. In late 1974, a CIA chief invited Jameson to assess one country's overall counterterrorism security picture. He confided that his contact, a general who headed the local intelligence and security service, seemed unconcerned about the potential for terrorist attacks on the government. In keeping with a tradition established by Donovan and Lovell, Jameson and his counterpart spent an evening drinking good brandy and devising a plan that would form the country's first counterterrorism program. A few days later, Jameson secured a meeting with the general, intending to offer a special training program for a new counterterrorism team. However, upon entering the general's office, Jameson faced an unreceptive host, despite the recent problems in the country from a foreign terrorist cell. The general dismissed the incidents as insignificant and isolated, and remained adamant that the country had no terrorist problem that needed CIA assistance. Jameson saw an opening. "Well, that's good," he responded, "but I have a bet for you. I believe I can walk down to your marketplace, make a few purchases, and within a few days, create an explosive device that I can then plant in a public location to kill any important foreign guest that comes into this country." The intelligence chief nearly exploded with anger. Jameson had challenged his fundamental responsibility, the protection of the country's leader and his international guests. Several minutes passed, and when the conversation calmed, Jameson suggested that the general personally choose one of his officers to accompany him as a guide and translator for a few days to prove or disprove his bold wager. During the next 3 days, Jameson and his guide wandered the markets of the capital city and purchased remote-controlled model airplanes, ammonium nitrate fertilizer, diesel fuel, and parts to make improvised detonators, everything necessary to make a powerful bomb. Jameson then checked into the hotel directly across the street from the intelligence chief's office and spent 2 days observing and making notes about security at the hotels, on the streets, and at entrances to government buildings. Returning to brief the general, Jameson was greeted with a slight smile.
"So, you wasted your time, didn't you? You see, we're really secure here," the intelligence chief said.
Jameson pulled a small U.S. government-issued green-covered notebook from his pocket and began reading from his notes. "I bought radio control switches to activate a bomb. I bought ammonium nitrate for the explosive. I bought a tourist suitcase to hold the bomb," he recited. "I bought fuses, timers, and initiators. Here's a list of the prices I paid for each item. I can get as many as I want. I can make one or several bombs, and I can make a big one or a small one. See, it's all here, and your man knows that I have it all in my hotel room." The general remained unconvinced.
"That might be so, but you can never use it operationally here," he said. "You could never get close to my VIP guests."
Jameson was prepared. "Sir, look outside your window. There's a big sedan parked across the street, right in front of the hotel where all your guests stay. I would load that car up with explosives, sit on my balcony, and wait for your guest to come out. I'd push the button and, boom, no more VIP. The general was stubborn.
"No, that wouldn't work either. My security guys are well-trained, well-armed, and know how to protect VIPs. They would spot anything out of the ordinary, like that car."
"We've checked," Jameson shot back. "That car hasn't been moved for 3 weeks. The intelligence chief agreed to consider what Jameson had reported. Included in Jameson's final security report was an item that would prove eerily prophetic. It warned of the dangers posed by a long-standing tradition in the country whereby petitioners could ask the head of state for assistance by pleading their case in person. Jameson assessed the vulnerabilities of the petitioner ceremony and concluded that a high probability of assassination against the leader existed. He noted that petitioners approached the ruler one at a time without being screened, searched, or x-rayed. To emphasize the point, he added that close associates and extended family members had nearly unrestricted access to the head of state. Nothing would prevent one of these from carrying a concealed pistol and shooting at close range. While that portion of Jameson's report was ignored, other pieces of a U.S.-proposed counterterrorism program began falling into place. The general understood the vulnerability presented by the example of the unidentified automobile parked near his office, and a few weeks later, a commercial airplane, with its windows covered with blackout paper, landed at a covert CIA training site. The passengers were members of a special counterterrorism and VIP protection team sent by the general for a month of intense training by OTS specialists. As the team disembarked, Jameson personally greeted each one. Now having proved himself a friend of the country, he began having regular meetings with the general to offer advice and planning assistance. In the mid-1970s, after completing one of his now frequent meetings with the general, Jameson headed home. During a stopover, as he approached the boarding gate to catch a connecting flight, he was surprised to see another CIA officer waiting for him. The general was demanding that Jameson return immediately. The country's leader had been assassinated. Let me guess. He was holding an audience, the people were standing in line, and he was sitting there talking to one of them, and they shot him in the head, Jameson said. How did you know that? The colleague asked, taken back by the specific details. I told the general 6 months ago that would happen. I didn't have a premonition, but I saw how the petitioners approached and how he was unprotected from his inner circle. The risk was obvious. You were right. The assassin was a relative. Jameson knew he was in a delicate situation. Not only had the assassination occurred uncomfortably soon after his report, but he had just departed the country hours before the shooting. If the general believed he was somehow implicated in the murder, Jameson could be arrested the instant he stepped off the plane. On the other hand, if Jameson didn't honor the request to return, they might assume that he, along with the CIA, was guilty of something. Jameson spent a sleepless night in limbo as cable traffic was exchanged with headquarters. All eventually agreed that it would be best for the OTS officer to go directly to the general, tell what was known, and offer personal as well as agency assistance. It was not a comfortable meeting. The general launched a tirade about the ineffectiveness of CIA counterintelligence training while implying that Jameson might have had some connection with the assassination. Letting the accusations pass without comment, Jameson replied, "I told you how I would go about doing this. I didn't say I was going to do it. I told you what was needed to correct the situation, but you didn't correct it. What has happened is past. Where do we go in the future?" "You stay here for now," the chief ordered, concluding the meeting. After several days of being under virtual house arrest, Jameson requested another meeting. The general had calmed down and conceded that no blame for the assassination lay with Jameson or the CIA. He was free to leave the country. However, for the remainder of his career, Jameson would be part of CIA's counterterrorism mission, and within a few months, tragedy struck firsthand. In December 1975, Jameson's CIA chief in Athens, Richard Welch, died from a terrorist's bullet. Among terrorists' standard weapons are small amounts of explosives fashioned into improvised devices and concealed in everyday items. Although small, these bombs can create physical damage as well as instill fear in a larger population. Less than an ounce of explosive is needed for a letter bomb capable of killing or maiming anyone around it. A few pounds of explosive hidden in a purse, briefcase, or suitcase can bring down an airliner, while a few hundred pounds in a car or van is capable of destroying an entire office building or embassy. Bill Parr had a cramped office in southern Europe during the late 1970s, but that mattered little, since most of his work was on the road. As one of the few OTS bomb techs, Parr frequently received the first call after bombings in Africa or the Middle East. CIA stations found that after bombings, foreign services were especially receptive to hosting techs like Parr, who knew how to conduct post-blast investigations and analyze security weaknesses. Parr was asleep at home when a phone call awakened him at 2 a.m.